So this is a course in bifurcation theory for computational cell biologists, and I want to begin by trying to motivate the use of bifurcation theory in understanding the molecular control of aspects of cell physiology. So I'll start with this slide that kind of indicates the direction we're going in. As molecular cell biologists, we draw information from many different areas of cell biology and biochemistry and genetics, and we use that information to draw what you can call box and arrow diagrams or wiring diagrams, biocarta charts, and they have fancy icons that represent cell membranes and the nucleus and chromosomes and protein molecules and arrows that hook them together. Those are essentially molecular mechanisms. There are hypotheses that we have of what we think is the underlying control mechanism for some aspect of cell physiology, be it cell cycle or the immune system or a signaling pathway. We draw this information from many different sources. We put it together in a fancy wiring diagram, and experimentalists tend to use these wiring diagrams as memory aids and as kind of intuitive devices for interpreting experiments and designing experiments. And for that purpose, the diagrams are very useful and productive. But as, say, physical biochemists, we can take the diagrams a little bit more seriously, and we tend to try to convert those diagrams into a set of kinetic equations that would describe the temporal evolution of the control system, and we would like to compare the solutions of those kinetic equations with the observed behaviors of cells. So the flow of information is essentially down towards these kinetic equations, which we want to use as a basic tool for connecting molecular mechanisms back to cell biology. So let me just use this example in this lecture, which is the interactions among a group of proteins that form an enzyme called MPF, mitosis promoting factor. Mitosis promoting factor is a protein kinase. It's a heterodimer with a kinase subunit called CDK and a regulatory subunit called cyclin. And when those two proteins get together, it activates the kinase activity, and this kinase phosphorylates various proteins in the cells and drive DNA replication and mitosis, in this case, mitosis promoting factor. And the diagram shows the three principal ways in which the activity of mitosis promoting factor is controlled. The kinase subunit, CDK, is present in excess and at constant levels throughout the cell cycle. Its activity is controlled primarily by the availability of its cyclin partner. Cyclin molecules can be rapidly synthesized in the cell and also rapidly degraded in the cell. So this arrow would be cyclin synthesis and cyclin degradation. So there's fast turnover of the cyclin subunits. When the cyclins are available, they find a kinase partner to form the active heterodimer. But that active heterodimer can be inactivated in two ways. One way is to phosphorylate the kinase subunit, and that puts the dimer into an inactive form. And the other way it's controlled is it can bind with a third protein called a CKI, a cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor, to form these inactive trimers. Okay? So the coming and going of these proteins controls the level of activity of mitosis promoting factor and controls whether the cell goes into mitosis or not. Okay, so that's what I mean by a wiring diagram, by a molecular mechanism. It's a hypothesis as to how this activity is controlled in the cell. Okay, now, as a physical biochemist, we can convert a diagram like this into a set of biochemical kinetic equations that describe the rates of synthesis and degradation, the rates of all the reactions in the wiring diagram. So we can convert a wiring diagram into a set of kinetic equations by writing one differential equation for each component in the network. There are maybe a half a dozen components in this network. And the way we construct these equations is just to look at the arrow coming into cyclin. That's a rate at which cyclin is being produced. So we describe that by some rate constant K1. Then there's an arrow coming out of cyclin. That's the rate at which cyclin is degraded, some rate proportional to the concentration of cyclin. And then there's cyclin can combine with CDK to form the dimer. So there's the association reaction, and the dimer can dissociate to go back to the two monomers. Okay, so those are all the reactions that change the concentration of cyclin. And then we write a second equation for the concentration of MPF. It's produced by the combination of cyclin and CDK. It can dissociate, and it can be degraded, so that's this step. Step 5 is the degradation of the cyclin subunit. And then steps 6 and 7 are the phosphorylation and dephosphorylation reactions. And step 8 and 9 are the association and dissociation to the CKI. Okay, and then we just keep working our way down or through the network, creating the differential equations that we need. And eventually, in this case, we'll get a set of 6 or 8 differential equations with maybe 15 parameters, which describe the rates of these reactions. And in principle, these differential equations should determine the dynamical characteristics of the molecular mechanism. And if we could solve those equations, we could compare the solutions back to the behavior of the cells and see if our mechanism is sufficient to describe the behavior of the cells. The problem with this procedure is what I call the curse of parameter space. As we write these differential equations, we begin collecting rate constants that describe the rates of all these reactions, and we don't know what these rate constants are. And it might be quite a large parameter space. There might be 20 different rate constants in a reasonably simple model to compare to experiments. And all these parameters have to be estimated from the data, and that can be a very difficult, if not impossible, task with so many parameters. We need a different way of thinking about and handling the dynamical system to get information from the system without having to know detailed, reliable values of all the parameters from the very beginning. We need a different way to think about the solutions of the differential equations. And that's where bifurcation theory comes in. So, here's the different way to think about a set of differential equations. Let me back up. Okay, so here are our differential equations. I've only written 2 differential equations, but there are, as I say, 6 or 7 differential equations to describe this network. Okay, now we want to think of these differential equations as driving changes in a state space. And the state space is the space that's spanned by the concentrations of all the variable chemicals in your network. So we need one dimension to describe the concentration of cyclin, a second dimension to describe the concentration of MPF, a third dimension to describe this trimer concentration, and a fourth dimension, and a fifth, and a sixth dimension. Okay, so we need a high-dimensional state space. To visualize that, I'll just try to draw 3 of the dimensions. But remember, this state space is multi-dimensional. Now, let's just find a point in this state space. So the blue dot represents an arbitrary state of the system, some combination of the concentrations of all the different components in the network. Now, what are the differential equations trying to tell us? The differential equations are trying to tell us how the concentrations of these components are changing in time. So let's attach to the point in state space some little arrows that indicate the amount of change in each of the components over a small interval of time. Okay, so these little arrows are the changes in the concentration of cyclin, CKI, and MPF. And those changes can be calculated from the differential equations. Because if I know my starting point, if I know the concentrations, and if I know the rate constants, I can substitute those numbers into the right-hand side of the differential equations and get the rate of change, multiply the rate of change by a little delta t, a little time unit, and that will tell me the little small changes in each one of the components. Okay? And they're the little arrows that stick out of my point in state space. So now I can take a composition vector where I compose the little changes in each independent direction into one vector that points in some direction in the state space from that initial condition. And this vector now tells me the direction in which the system will change over the next small unit of time if I start at that blue dot. Okay? Now the blue dot where I started was an arbitrary position in the state space. So I can imagine now sampling many hundreds or thousands or millions of positions in the state space and attaching to each one of those points a vector that's determined by the differential equations. Okay? So let's just try to do that. Schematically, we draw some representative vectors attached to different points in the state space. Okay? And this is the proper way to think about a dynamical system, a set of differential equations. What the differential equations are defining is a vector field in the state space. Okay? So the state space is this n-dimensional space of concentrations of all your time-varying components. And the vector field are these little direction arrows defined at every point in the state space. Okay? So the way we connect this with the underlying molecular biology is that the molecular mechanism defines the kinetic equations, the differential equations, and the differential equations define the vector field on the state space. Now, what does the vector field tell us? Well, the vector field allows us, if we have enough of these vectors to see what's happening, the vector field allows us to kind of trace out any solution of the differential equation. If I start at this point that I've been considering, the vector tells me which direction to go, and then as I move along, I have to keep consulting the vector field and just follow the direction of the vector field, and it will lead me along a trajectory through the state space. It'll lead me somewhere. In this case, it seems to be spiraling down onto a steady state. So if we know the vector field, then we can visualize any solution of the differential equations just by following the directions. And that then introduces the notion of attractors and repellers and transients. So an attractor is a solution of the differential equation that you tend the trajectory tends towards. In this case, the attractor might be a steady state, a stable steady state. A repeller are solutions that that repel trajectories. Trajectories move away from those solutions. And between attractors and repellers are the transient solutions of the differential equations. And all of these solutions have significance in terms of the physiology of the cell. The attractors are the stable, steady states of the cell. The repellers are unstable states that the cell can't sit at. The transients describe how a cell responds to a perturbation. You kick it off one attractor and it comes back or goes to a different attractor. The transient tells you how the cell responds to various perturbations. So if we could characterize the attractors and repellers and transients of the vector field, we would have a complete understanding of the possible physiology of the system. And we can compare it to experiments and see whether our model is any good or not. Okay? So this is a kind of visual or conceptual way to think of molecular mechanisms, associating them with something physiological by passing through the kinetic equations and the notion of the vector field. Now notice, I haven't yet solved any differential equation. I've only presented you with a way of thinking about differential equations. At the end of the day, when you need a solution, then you need the computer to help you. Because actually, nobody ever does this transient by hand. That's what computers are really good at. And you can always ask the computer to solve the differential equation, and the computer will follow the vector field and trace out the solutions for you. But there's no hope of asking the computer to do a sensible calculation for you unless you know what to expect out of your differential equations. You have to be able to visualize in your mind's eye this vector field and what's happening to this vector field before you ask the computer to actually make a computation. Otherwise, the computer will give you stuff you just can't possibly understand. Okay? You with me? Now, this view, this understanding of differential equations actually dates back more than 100 years to a famous French mathematician named Henri Poincaré. And he was responding to a prize that was announced by, I don't know, the King of France or Belgium or someplace. Because people who were studying celestial mechanics and writing down Newton's equations for the sun and the planets and the moons, they had kind of come to the end of their rope. They had very complicated differential equations that they couldn't solve with the tools that they were trying to use. And the prize was to come up with a new way of attacking this problem. And Poincaré responded to that challenge by developing this whole notion of the vector field and characterizing the vector field without trying to solve the differential equations from the very start. And it was a revolutionary way of thinking about differential equations and dynamical systems that's still bearing fruit today. Okay, so we can now extend our little diagram here, which I call, by the way, the dynamical perspective in molecular cell biology. We're tracing what we know about molecules and cells through a hypothetical molecular mechanism to define and characterize a vector field in the state space of the system. But I still haven't made a connection back to the cell biology. So let's see where bifurcation theory comes in to make this connection. I'm going to try to talk about how the attractors and repellers of a vector field are described by bifurcation diagrams, and that bifurcation diagrams can be associated with what a physiologist calls a signal response curve. And that's the way we can close the loop. So, let me again try to explain this by coming back to my example of the regulation of the activity of MPF. And I'm going to simplify the system down to just two differential equations, so it's a little easier to describe. So one differential equation is going to describe the concentration of active MPF, and the other differential equation describes the total concentration of cyclin in the system in these different forms. But remember, everything I tell you and illustrate with these two differential equations carries over to any number of differential equations, because I'm always going to be talking about the vector fields, and the vector fields generalize to any number of equations. But it's a little easier to draw these vector fields when we only have two-dimensional state space, because then I can draw it on the plane. Okay? So this is called the phase plane. It's the state space for our two-dimensional system, and I've drawn a representative sampling of this vector field. Now, how to characterize this vector field? Well, first of all, notice that this vertical line divides up the vector field. On the left-hand side, all the vectors are pointing to the right, and on the right-hand side, all the vectors are pointing to the left. And this line that divides them is the place where the vector field has no component in the east-west direction. It's only going in the north-south direction. So that's a place, that vertical line is a place where the time derivative of the cyclin concentration is equal to zero. The time derivative of the cyclin concentration is the motion in the east-west direction. And along this line, there's no motion in the east-west direction. So the time derivative of cyclin is equal to zero. It's sometimes called a nullcline or a balance curve. There's a second curve that divides the vector field up into vectors which have a southerly component from vectors which are only pointing to the north. And that curve is the place where the time derivative of MPF is equal to zero. So there's no vertical component, there's only a horizontal component. And now I can start to fill in the vectors. They're all horizontal along the MPF nullcline, and they're vertical along the cyclin nullcline. And where the two nullclines intersect are places where both time derivatives are equal to zero. So those are steady state solutions of the differential equations. So we can immediately see where the steady states are. In this case, there are three different steady states. And furthermore, we can see the stability of these steady states. The upper steady state, if you look at the vector field around the upper steady state, all the vectors point back towards the steady state. So that steady state is locally stable. If you push the system off the upper steady state, as long as you don't push it too far, then you'll come back to the upper steady state. So we can draw in a few representative trajectories. Okay? But what you notice, the upper steady state and the lower steady state are locally stable, but the steady state in between, the white steady state, some vectors are coming towards the steady state and other vectors are going away from the steady state. That's called a saddle point. Okay? The two extreme steady states are nodes. They're stable nodes. Trajectories come right back to the steady state. And the intermediate state is called a saddle point because some trajectories come towards it and other trajectories go away. Okay? So this is a very typical kind of response of a nonlinear dynamical system like this. Okay? So we have state space, vector field, we have steady state solutions, some of them are attractors, and the saddle point is a repeller, and those red trajectories that I just erased, those would be the transients. Okay, so that characterizes the solutions of these differential equations for these particular parameter values. But the next question we want to ask is, how do the solutions change as we start to change the parameter values? And the parameter that I want to change is the rate constant K1, which is the rate of synthesis of cyclin. That's just a convenient one to change. We could change other parameters and the same sorts of things would happen. This is the one that's the easiest to understand. So what happens if we increase K1 a little bit? Now cyclin is being synthesized faster and the nullcline moves a little bit to the left. but we still have three steady states, two stable steady states, and one unstable steady state. So there's been no qualitative change in the nature of the solutions. Okay, go back. I can change K1, I could move it in the other direction. There would be no qualitative change in the solution of the differential equations. But if I increase K1, whoops, if I increase K1 a little bit further, now there's a very dramatic qualitative change in the nature of the solutions. Two of the solutions have disappeared, and we have now a single stable, steady-state solution of the differential equations. That's called a bifurcation point. The bifurcation point is the particular value of K1 where the two null clines come together in this curious fashion, where they just graze each other here. The stable node and the unstable saddle point have come together and merged into a point that's called a saddle node. And the saddle node attracts trajectories in three directions, but it repels trajectories in one direction. And that's the bifurcation point. What we mean by a bifurcation point is a critical value of the parameter where the solutions of the differential equations, the characteristics of the attractors and repellers of the vector field, undergo a dramatic qualitative change. Okay? So, on one side of the saddle point, it looks like that. And on the other side of the saddle point, it looks like that. This is, on this side of the saddle point, there are always three steady states. And on the other side of the saddle node bifurcation, there's only one steady state. Okay, so that's the notion of a bifurcation point. Now, we can describe this particular kind of bifurcation in something called a one-parameter bifurcation diagram. In a one-parameter bifurcation diagram, I'm going to choose one of the parameters, one of the rate constants in the differential equation, as the parameter I'm going to change. And on the vertical axis, I'm going to plot the steady state concentration of one of the variables in my system. Now, I'm going to choose the activity of MPF because that's the component I would be interested in. As a cell biologist, I want to know whether I've got a lot of mitosis-promoting factor activity or a little bit. And the parameter I'm choosing is the rate of synthesis of cyclin. And I want to draw a diagram that characterizes the steady state solutions of the differential equations as a function of the parameter. And in this particular case, the one parameter bifurcation diagram has this S shape. These diagrams are always drawn with a solid line to represent a stable steady state and a dashed line to represent an unstable steady state. And this bifurcation diagram indicates that for some values of the parameter K1, the system has two stable steady states. It's said to be bistable, but for other values of the parameters, the system is monostable, has only a low steady state or a high steady state. And the bifurcation point is right here where the curves come together at these folds. There are two saddle node bifurcation points. Okay? Now, let me make sure we understand how to interpret a bifurcation diagram and why a one-parameter bifurcation diagram is such a powerful tool. Remember, the wiring diagram for any kind of a realistic control system is going to have lots of proteins and lots of reactions. It's going to be pretty complicated, okay? And the differential equations that we write down to describe that diagram are going to be many differential equations and many parameters. And the state space that describes the system is an n-dimensional state space. We can't draw it. We can't even visualize it. We have to just imagine it in our mind's eye. It could be 20, 30, 40-dimensional state space. And there are lots of different parameters. Any one of them we can pick. I mean, experimentally, whenever you do an experiment, basically you pick out a parameter and you change the parameter and see how the system responds to that change in that parameter, okay? And as we change the parameters in the differential equations, the vector field changes. And as the vector field changes, the nature of the solutions of the differential equations change. That's what we're trying to capture with a one-parameter bifurcation diagram. Now, no matter how many state variables there are, we pick one of them as a representative variable for the whole system. We pick one state variable and plot it on the y-axis. And no matter how many parameters there are, we pick one parameter as representative of all the complications of the parameter space, and we plot that on the x-axis. Okay? Now, it makes sense to choose as the parameter the thing that you're controlling experimentally, and to choose as your state variable one of the things that you're measuring experimentally. But it actually doesn't really matter very much which variable you choose, which parameter you choose. The nature of the bifurcation diagrams are generic. That means you can prove mathematically that these bifurcation diagrams have certain generic properties that you can expect to see. And in this case, if the system shows bistability, you ought to be able to see a bifurcation diagram that looks more or less like this, with an S-shaped curve, no matter which variable you choose or which parameter you choose. So the bifurcation diagram is a two-dimensional representation of the dynamical characteristics of a very complicated system with, say, 30 variables and 100 parameters. We can reduce it all down to this simple two-dimensional plot. And the mathematics behind it assures us that we're not fooling ourselves. Now you have to understand what this bifurcation diagram is trying to tell you. We've distilled this complicated vector space down into this two-dimensional representation. Now, here's how to go back. If we choose a specific value of the parameter K1 and we look at the bifurcation diagram says that the system has two stable steady states and one unstable steady state. And behind the bifurcation diagram is the state space. And for our simple model, I can draw the state space, the XY state space, but again, it could be many, many dimensions with a complicated vector field, but what the bifurcation diagram tells us is that that vector field has two stable attractors and one repeller. So it's distilled the information in the state space down to a simple diagram. Now, the experiment that we do is, say, to increase the rate of synthesis of cyclin in the cell. If we start with a low rate of synthesis, MPF is a low activity, we call that the off state, but as the parameter K1 increases and we pass the saddle node bifurcation point, the lower steady state is destroyed and the system has to make an abrupt transition to the upper steady state, and now we see plenty of MPF activity. So we can think of the one-parameter bifurcation diagram as telling us something about the signal response characteristics of this dynamical system. So here's my signal, a linear increase in the parameter as a function of time. Steady linear increase in the parameter as a function of time. And how does the system respond to that input? Well, it stays at a low value of MPF until we get past the bifurcation point, and then it abruptly jumps to a high value of MPF. So that's the signal response curve that's associated with this one parameter bifurcation diagram. And if I do the reverse experiment, and now I'm on the upper steady state, and I reduce the rate of synthesis of cyclin, I'll stay on the upper steady state until I get to the other saddle node bifurcation, and then make the transition down. So this one parameter bifurcation diagram makes specific predictions about the signal response curves of the cell that it's supposed to be describing. You with me? Okay, we can actually do experiments to test this idea, because this little model of the control of the activity of mitosis promoting factor is actually a reasonably good description of what's going on inside a fertilized frog egg. And it, when a frog egg gets fertilized, what happens is, the first thing that happens after fertilization is that any cyclin molecules in the egg are destroyed, and the cyclin activity goes down to zero. And then, after fertilization, the egg begins to make new cyclin molecules. And at first, as the cyclin molecules accumulate, there's no activity of M-phase promoting factor because it's all in this inactive phosphorylated form. And you have to wait until, the egg has to wait until it accumulates enough cyclin to get past the saddle node bifurcation point, and then it can activate MPF and go into mitosis. So when it's on the lower branch of the bifurcation curve, the egg is in interphase, it's replicating its DNA, but the egg doesn't go into mitosis and undergo cell division until MPF gets activated, until you jump from the lower steady state to the upper steady state. At least that's the interpretation. And actually, that interpretation, I'll show you, is well supported by experiments. So the experiments I'm going to describe were done in Jill Seibel's lab by Wei Sha a couple of years ago, 7 years ago or so. Wei Sha was one of the first PhD students in the GBCB program. But before she joined GBCB, she got a master's in the biology department for these very beautiful experiments that I'm going to describe. So, what's the idea? The idea is that if we increase the amount of cyclin, we're using frog egg extracts, and we increase the total amount of cyclin in the extract, at first we'll see no MPF activity, and then when we get enough cyclin in the extract, all of a sudden we'll get lots of MPF activity. So this is Wei Sha's experiment, measuring MPF activity as a function of the total amount of cyclin in a series where she's steadily increasing the concentration of cyclin. And when this MPF activity is low, the nuclei are in interphase, and that's what nuclei look like when they're in interphase. They're little round balls, and the DNA, which is stained blue, is uniformly distributed in the nucleus. But then, all of a sudden, when the MPF activity jumps to a high level, those nuclei go into mitosis, the nuclear envelope breaks down, the chromosomes condense, and a mitotic spindle is built. Okay? So you really can see a physiological change associated with this biochemical change. And this is very abrupt. In this experiment, we went from 30 nanomolar to 60 nanomolar, but take my word for it, even if this were a 40, there would be plenty of MPF activity, and the nuclei would be in mitosis. Now, if our understanding of the control system is correct, then what we are observing here, this abrupt activation of MPF, is because the cyclin level has increased beyond the saddle node bifurcation point and we've jumped to the upper branch. If that's a correct interpretation, then if we now reduce the cyclin level in the extract, we should follow the upper branch to a different saddle node bifurcation and then switch off. So that was the second half of the experiments in which Wei Sha is measuring MPF activity in a sequence where she starts with lots of cyclin and MPF active, and she reduces the amount of cyclin, the MPF activity drops, but the nuclei are still in mitosis. And you have to get down to around 18 nanomolar before the system switches off and you go back to the background level of cyclin-dependent kinase activity. And furthermore, the nuclei here, these nuclei are in mitosis, and they don't go back to interphase until they get to the low-level cyclin.
So you're
In the way this experiment is, the cyclin level in the extract is fixed, and it's an experimentally controllable parameter. But I didn't want to go into the technical details of how the experiment's done. So in particular, for intermediate levels of the cyclin in these extracts, the system can be either in the off state with no MPF activity and the nuclei in interphase, or for exactly the same cyclin concentrations, the system can be in the on state with plenty of MPF activity and the nuclei are in mitosis. That's the hallmark of a bistable system. That's the proof that, indeed, this mechanism is bistable, and the classical bifurcation diagram is completely consistent with the biochemical and physiological properties of this control system. Now, that was in an extract that was manipulated experimentally so that the cyclin level was kept fixed. In the intact egg, actually cyclin is constantly being synthesized and degraded. And cyclin synthesis is always adding material to MPF, but there's also a process of cyclin degradation, which is removing cyclin from the system. In the frog egg, the cyclin synthesis is at a constant rate, but cyclin degradation is done periodically. It's done periodically because cyclin degradation is catalyzed by an enzyme called the APC, and the APC is activated by active MPF. So when the MPF activity is low, the APC is off, cyclin's not being degraded, but it is being synthesized, so cyclin accumulates. So here we are in the state space with our vector field. When the MPF activity is low, degradation is small, and cyclin is accumulating. So the vectors point to the right. But when MPF activity gets high, then APC is active and cyclin is being degraded and the vector field points to the left. And this is the null cline for the cyclin, where cyclin synthesis and cyclin degradation are balanced. Now when we see the null clines and when we see the vector field, we see how this system responds to cyclin synthesis. First, cyclin accumulates so you get past that nose, and then MPF gets activated, and then cyclin gets degraded, and then MPF gets inactivated, and this system will run around a loop around this unstable steady state. And that's exactly what's observed experimentally. These experiments were done in Jim Ferrell's lab at Stanford University by Joe Pomerani. Made very careful measurements of total cyclin in the frog egg extract and MPF activity as functions of time, and then they plot total MPF activity as a function of total cyclin, and they see as time proceeds, the extract goes round and round the loop exactly as predicted by the state space and the vector field. That loop is called a stable limit cycle. It's a different kind of attractor, different from a stable steady state. Okay? So here's what the bifurcation diagram looks like for the birth of a stable limit cycle from a stable steady state. So remember what a bifurcation one parameter bifurcation diagram is. The variable, if we choose MPF as our variable and K1 as the parameter, for low values of K1, there's just a single stable steady state. But as the parameter K1 increases, that steady state loses stability. It becomes an unstable steady state. And stable limit cycle oscillations are born when the steady state loses its stability. And how do you interpret the bifurcation diagram? If you fix the value of K1 at this point, then the system will oscillate around the limit cycle, and what you'll see is the MPF activity oscillates up and down between its maximum activity and its minimum activity. This is called a hop bifurcation. The previous one was called a saddle node bifurcation. This is called a hop bifurcation, and that's the bifurcation point where this change of behavior occurs. Okay. So, what I've tried to establish for you now is this connection between bifurcation diagrams and signal response curves. What a bifurcation diagram is telling you is the nature of the attractors and repellers of the vector field. It's characterizing how those things change as you change a parameter. But the point I'm trying to drive home is what a mathematician calls a bifurcation diagram, a cell physiologist calls a signal response curve, because it's the classic experiment in cell physiology is to vary one of the handles on your system and see how the cell responds. Signal response, parameter variable. Okay? They're the same thing. And if we can make the connection between the bifurcation diagrams and signal response curves, then we can close the loop from the kinetic equations back to the physiology of the cells. Okay, I'm almost done. So, I'm trying to motivate why we want to learn about bifurcation theory. Because one parameter bifurcation diagrams tie the dynamics of the control system back to the biology of the cell. And I've illustrated this with the two simplest bifurcations, generic bifurcations. The first is the saddle node bifurcation, where you change the number of steady states. At a saddle node bifurcation, you destroy a stable steady state because it combines with a saddle point and gets annihilated. And saddle node bifurcations, as I showed you, are associated with the phenomenon of bistability. System has two stable steady states. That allows the system to make a decision. In one steady state, it's in one type of physiology, and in the other steady state, it's in a different physiology. Okay? You're in interphase of the cell cycle, or you're in mitosis of the cell cycle. A bistable system is a decision-making system. And bistability, the phenomenon of bistability is controlled by saddle node bifurcations. And if you want to understand decision-making processes in the cell, there's no way around it. You have to understand saddle node bifurcations. That's how chemical systems make decisions. On the other hand, there are hop bifurcations, and at a hop bifurcation, that's where oscillations are created from stable steady states to stable oscillations. So all timekeeping that's done in living cells is associated probably one way or another with these sorts of bifurcations that create oscillations. Now, if you believe me and you're convinced, then the next question to ask is how many different kinds of bifurcations are there? There are lots of different kinds of signal response curves, right? If any good cell physiologist can describe to me a couple dozen different experiments where cells do all kinds of crazy things, characterized by signal response curves. How many kinds of bifurcations are there? If there are hundreds of different kinds of bifurcations, this would be a pretty scary endeavor. But as a matter of fact, what I want to show you in the course of the next 7 lectures is that there are only a very limited number of generic bifurcations of vector fields. Okay, and here's a list. It's not a complete list, but it's almost a complete list. The number of generic bifurcations of vector fields is just a handful. Like I've got six there, and there are a few more. Okay? So that's what we have to learn. That's what we have to master, these elementary bifurcations. And then all the complicated stuff that a dynamical system can do is somehow a conglomeration of what these elementary bifurcations do. And if the physiology of the cell is indeed described by nonlinear differential equations that describe the underlying biochemical network, then these bifurcations have to lead us to the possible types of physiology that we can see in signal response curves. Okay? So it's a very manageable task. Hopefully we can get through it in six more lectures, at least to see what the basic properties of these bifurcations are. Okay? So that's our job. We'll study saddle node and hop bifurcations in the next couple of lectures, and then these more complicated bifurcations we'll get to a little bit later. So I'll show you what all the different one-parameter bifurcation diagrams look like. And then at the end of the course, I'll introduce the notion of a two-parameter bifurcation diagram and how to use two-parameter bifurcation diagrams to connect the genetics of the cell to the physiology of the cell through the notion of what happens to these vector fields. Okay, thank you.